Today, 2018 was a huge year for climate change, and this year will prove even more important. So as 2019 gets into full swing, what action do we need to take in the fight for the planet? And in opinion, David Conn on how football and the gambling industry have become inseparable.
I've been covering this for quite a long time, and the urgency grows with every year. The problem gets worse and the solution gets harder with every year you wait. And we're really at the edge of being able to reverse it right now.
In 2018, the effects of climate change became hard to ignore.
California recorded its deadliest and most destructive ever wildfire, a blaze which ravaged the town of Paradise, leaving 86 people dead. The Trump administration made no mention of climate change.
I don't even know where I am. It's on fire. And we're stuck in the middle of it. And these trees can come down at any moment.
Now, Sweden has called for international help to fight more than 40 wildfires that have broken out across the country. Weeks of high temperatures and minimal rain.
In 2018, it's Cape Town, South Africa in the news. Now, in its third year of drought,
as Cape Town is preparing for the day when and the beast from the east.
More than 51 Celsius in Algeria this month, the hottest ever recorded images on.
Well, meanwhile, in Japan, yet 65 people have now died.
At least 60 people to live with more than 1,000
in the worst.
Many people simply fled to the sea. Coast Guard rescued almost 700 from the air.
Climate change is happening much faster than we thought.
The new report from the UN predicts that at the current warming rate, millions more people will die from extreme heat by the year 2040.
In September, the UN Secretary General will invite all of the world's leaders to come together and draw up ambitious policies to try and get the world back on track. Because the reality is, the difference of just half a degree Celsius will determine the future of the planet. And that change is happening now. From The Guardian, I'm Indy Rackerson. Today in Focus, what can we do right now about climate change? John, last year was hugely important for climate change, and part of that was a series of pretty shocking scientific reports. What did they say?
Well, the key report was this one by the United Nations. That's generally called the 1.5 degrees Celsius report.
Jonathan Watts is The Guardian's global environment editor.
All of these warming numbers relate to what was the temperature like at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, before carbon emissions started being spewed on a massive scale into the air.
A couple of hundred years ago.
We've already warmed by more than 1 degree.
Scientists have been warning us for years that we can expect to see more extreme weather with climate change. The heat waves, wildfires, and heavy rainfall events of recent months all over the world underscore these warnings.
Now the scientists are looking forward and saying, should we set the world's target to try to limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, which is the range that the world has set so far under the Paris Agreement of a few years back? And until very recently, everybody thought 2 degrees was fine. But we now have this report showing the difference that just half a degree makes between 1.5 and 2, and it's huge.
There are clear benefits to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to 2 degrees or higher. Every bit of warming matters.
If you go beyond 1.5, the chance of saving any of the world's coral reefs almost disappears completely. So you're condemned the world's coral reefs with that extra half a degree. The Arctic sea ice in the summer would probably also get lost if you get to 2 degrees, but there's a chance of saving it at 1.5. And also hundreds of millions more people get affected with that extra half a degree. So this is kind of alarming stuff, and everybody, when this report came out, it caused a huge stir.
The message is, over to governments at this stage. We've told you the scientific facts, the evidence, the costs. It is up to the governments now to decide what to do with it.
I remember the headlines. It was about October, wasn't it, last year?
It was, that's right.
I just remember the headlines and just putting my head in my hands on the train. I just wanted to go, no, like really loudly, but it was terrifying.
Yeah, it wasn't much fun to write either. I've talked to so many climate scientists and they're wonderful people, absolutely committed, dedicated to their subject. And whenever I interview them, I always ask at the end, so that's what you've told me as a scientist. Now, as a human being, how do you feel about that? And everyone's like, oh, I'm frustrated, I'm concerned, I'm anxious. I really want the policymakers to get a move on because we're running out of time. That's why the scientists are really coming out much more now. You know, in the past, scientists were very objective. They stayed in their, you know, ivory towers or whatever you want to call it. We're telling you what's happened. Now you deal with it. And now you're finding more and more scientists coming out and speaking out. I spoke to one recently, Catherine Hayhoe.
Hi, did your laptop die?
No, I'm...
And she said, look, scientists are not dismembered brains floating in a jar. We're human beings. We know that the planet's going to be okay. The question is whether we're going to be okay, and we're frustrated and we're concerned and we want to do something. And she says that her hope is that what we are seeing at the moment is a slight effort to bend the curve down, to reduce the amount of emissions gradually. And this will proceed, and then you'll hit a point.
A sort of collective oh shit moment.
She called it the oh shit moment. When, for one reason
or right.
it does, where people start to realise and governments start to realise that the costs of climate change are much greater than the costs of the solutions. And then once you get that realisation in every country, she says you'll start to see like Manhattan projects and moon race level engagement and all scientists being pushed to one thing, all government resources being pushed in one way. And then you'll see a dramatic fall and things will really start to happen. The question is when that oh shit moment comes is crucial. We want it to come forward as soon as possible and we're not there yet.
This oh shit moment is coming and how quickly, nobody knows. But things don't look good, obviously. So is it actually possible to stop or slow climate change?
We can definitely slow it by reducing emissions. That's well known. And there's, you know, huge efforts underway to do that, moving away from coal and oil and moving towards renewables, cutting down on all sorts of waste, all the things we've been talking about for years. And then there are the more radical solutions, which generally go by the name geoengineering.
Geoengineering is a term used to describe large-scale targeted intervention in the Earth's atmosphere, the oceans, and the biosphere.
Which are the sort of more sci-fi way of dealing with problems, which are things like replicating what a volcano does and spreading kind of particulate matter into the atmosphere so that the sun's rays can't penetrate as much as before.
So-called stratospheric aerosol injection.
Which, of course, is, you know, hugely risky because, generally speaking, when there's, in the past, when there's been big volcanoes, it often affects harvests and things like that. So it might cause more problems than it solves. But there are other smaller scale things that are perhaps more encouraging. For example, there's a company in the US now that has found a way to suck carbon out of the air and turn it into stone or building blocks, which is fantastically
sounds like
useful.
Something, it actually sounds like something out of sci-fi or a cartoon. It's sort of like straight into a block.
It really does. And there's one other one that sounds totally like something out of James Bond, which is that you put big mirrors up in space and reflect some of the sun's rays, which, of course, could be totally used by Dr. Evil
to keep
one
film.
Area in darkness forever. I mean, yeah, I'm sure it is in a James Bond film somewhere.
This is the part I really like.
Now that's what I call solar power.
That's what I call trouble.
So anyway, there are all these far-out solutions that eventually might be necessary, although most scientists say, look, we have to study them. We need to know the options. We need to know how they work, what they might do. But at the moment, let's stick with what we have. Because if we start talking about possible technological solutions that actually might make things worse, people won't do anything now, and the whole point is to do something now. The biggest point they make is we already have this fantastic technology for sucking carbon out of the air, and it's called a tree. Why don't we just concentrate on what we have? But that's all about changing behavior and politics, and that is where the attention now needs to be focused, because all the economists, all the scientists say, we can do it technologically. We can do what needs to be done. What's missing is political will. This is where the real blockage is right now.
So let's talk about what's actually being done and start with this political will. Globally, the most important thing at the moment is the 2015 Paris Agreement, and that's this unprecedented agreement by all the world leaders to combat climate change. Last month, they met in Poland to try and decide on a rule book on how to reach deadlines and quotas. Was it a success at all, John?
There was an agreement by all nations to the final statement, which is good. So that means just about all nations are on board. Although the US has promised, Donald Trump has promised to pull out, the US is still in for the moment. The US will be in till right towards the end of Donald Trump's first term in 2020. So you had general agreement. Somewhat worryingly, you also saw this alliance of the world's 1, 2, and 3 fossil fuel producing nations, which is the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, who blocked efforts to welcome the United Nations 1.5 degree report. And so they're kind of slightly nudging the science to one side.
And fossil fuels will continue to play a leading role. Energy access.
...190 countries, in other words, all of the rest of the world, pretty much supported a motion to welcome the report. These four countries, the three I mentioned plus Kuwait, said, no, we only want to take note of it. It sounds tiny, but it caused this two-hour big emotional debate, and eventually, because there wasn't consensus, and it's the UN, they didn't adopt anything.
I declare this meeting of the COP, CMP and CMA to be adjourned.
So this was kind of downplayed somewhat, although other countries emphasise how important it is. And I think if it did anything, it showed more clearly than ever that the biggest obstacle here is those big fossil fuel interests. They increasingly have possession of some of the world's biggest governments.
All that seems very removed, the global leaders in a room arguing about climate change. But what voice can we have as individuals at a conference like that?
Well, you can either go through civil society organisations or your politicians, or in some cases, people are taking direct action and getting invited along. And the most striking of these cases was Greta Thunberg of Sweden, a 15-year-old girl who just one day decided that the adults were totally betraying her on climate change and decided to go on strike. She refused to go to school. She parked herself out of the parliament building in Sweden and has become this huge force on Twitter. She's doing TED Talks. She's sparked similar strikes in Australia and elsewhere. And she was invited along to the climate talks in Poland. And she stood up in front of thousands of people in suits and supposedly her elders and betters, although she certainly doesn't think that. And she said to them,
you are not mature enough to tell it like it is.
You're immature. You haven't done anything. Anyone can see that we can't carry on doing what we're doing. Even a child can see that. You say you love your children, and yet what you're doing proves that you don't.
You say you love your children above all else, and yet you're stealing their future in front of their very eyes.
And I think it's particularly significant that she's young, because this is such an intergenerational issue. And so I think you might start to see more youth movements rising up, protesting and going onto social networks to kind of raise this issue and this clearly gross unfairness that they've been left holding the problem.
Thank you. Right, so that's the global political stage for climate change. But people are taking action at home in their own countries too. And one example of that is people bringing environmental lawsuits.
There is a group of young people in the United States who are suing the government and saying they have a constitutional right to life that is being threatened by climate change and that the government needs to take more actions. And one of the people involved in that is the granddaughter of James Hansen.
In 1988, NASA scientist
first went in front of Congress in the late 1980s and said, look, there's this thing called climate change. You better wake up, better do something, because 30 years from now, it's going to be a big problem.
The next day, a New York Times headline proclaimed, quote, global warming has begun.
And now his granddaughter is involved in this suit. Then you've also got some cities, including New York City, who's suing some of the big oil companies. Say, you know, you're having these big hurricanes, they're damaging parts of the city, and there's a handful of companies who are responsible for a huge proportion of all the emissions that have ever been recorded historically. And then you've got another type of lawsuits in the Netherlands, where a group of campaigners took the government to court and said, you are not doing what you need to do to fulfill your commitments under the Paris Agreement. And they won. And that's forced the government to do more.
So not everybody has deep pockets or likes the idea of taking legal action. What else are people doing?
I think you're seeing a change in pitch in a way. People are joining groups that didn't exist before. So you have the traditional groups like your Greenpeaces and your NGOs. But in the past year, you've seen the rise of more direct action groups.
Protesters have blocked off five major bridges in central London today, demanding that the government takes greater action on climate change.
Such as Extinction Rebellion, the group that blocked lots of bridges in London towards the end of last year. There is this heightened intensity in the action that some people are taking, certainly more than I can remember in many years.
John, it feels like there is a lot to do and it's a dizzying amount, but are there really pressing things that we can do right now, today, on an individual level? Obviously, you look at this all the time. So what would be your top three things that people have to do?
Could I have a top four?
Yes, you're allowed four. That's
thank
fine.
You.
It's important enough.
Well, in reverse order, number four is think about your home. One of the best things you can do is insulate your home. You're going to save money for that anyway. Fit solar panels. I know that's not an option for everybody. Hang your clothes to dry rather than use an electric dryer. Dial down the air conditioner a notch. All of those things can make some difference. At number three, travel in a way that's as green as possible. So obviously use a bicycle, use public transport. If you have to use a car, then car share, or perhaps some people can buy electric vehicles. And most important of all, cut down on flights whenever you can, because that's the most carbon intensive way of traveling that there is. Number two, I would say meat consumption. It's crucial because if we eat beef, that involves a lot of deforestation in other parts of the world very often. If you are going to eat beef, eat locally produced beef, and if possible, have one day a week. Start with one day a week without meat, and then maybe build up, and you might be able to get to only having meat at the weekends. And some people might prefer to go vegan or vegetarian, and that can make a huge difference. And if you do eat meat, chicken is less carbon intensive than beef, and pork is somewhere in between, as is lamb. But beyond all of those small individual actions, number one is act politically, trying to get collective action by campaigning, by joining political parties, by funding certain groups, by raising your voice on certain issues, by talking to the people around you to really focus attention on this issue. I would say in the last year or two, it's been incredibly frustrating to see how all the attention has been on Brexit and Trump and a million other things we have to be concerned about in this world, but almost none of them are an existential threat. And climate change is an existential threat, and not a distant existential threat, not really. And so this is what we should be focusing on. This is what we should be talking about. And this is where we should be sort of looking for ways to go forward and collaborate together to get action. I think that's the key.
And get that oh shit moment of realization there, get there sooner.
That is the essence right now. is to get awareness to the point where we reach that oh shit moment and we think, right, what's happened up to now is going to be a disaster if we continue. We've got to find something different. Change can happen. For example, the Me Too movement. 10 years ago, most people wouldn't have thought that was possible. Certainly 30 years ago, that seemed like a flight of fancy for a lot of people. But it will only happen if people talk about it, people learn what's going on, people do what they can do in small ways, and if they join bigger movements to try to amplify their voice, because individuals can do a lot, but we will not ultimately make a difference on our own. We can only make a difference if we make this political, if we make this a collective effort.
John Watts, thank you so much.
Very welcome, thank you.
Do check out all the latest environmental reporting by Jonathan Watts and his colleagues at theguardian.com. Up next, what the relentless push of gambling adverts on football fans has done to the supporters and the sport.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian subscriptions.
Now, it's being called the gamblification of football. New research has shown how deregulation of gambling and the rise of new technology has created a generation of young men that cannot separate watching football from betting, with dire consequences. Here's David Conn.
From April 2017 to March 2018, an extraordinary £14.4 billion was lost by people betting in the UK. It's unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable, isn't it? And it's just being sucked out of young people and just ordinary people. And you know, it's been described to me as one of the biggest ever redistributions from the poor to the rich. 9 out of the 20 Premier League clubs, which are obviously watched all over the world, have a gambling company as their main shirt sponsor. And 17 out of the 24 Championship clubs, the second division, have also got gambling companies on their shirts. And on top of that, the clubs have what they call betting partners, which do other kinds of advertising. And there are very big adverts for gambling around the pitch on billboards. Sky Bet sponsors the Football League itself. It's absolutely relentless. It is soaked into football now.
You can find us in every corner of the world. We are everywhere.
Do it your way with RequestaBet. Combine all your hunches on tonight's game into one unique bet.
Which means when I win, I could win bigger.
That's betting better. When the fun stops, stop.
A generation of younger people, mostly younger men, have grown up with this level of gambling being normalised and this level of sport, particularly football, being so completely immersed in gambling. These new findings come from landmark research that's been done by an academic, Darren McGee, at the University of Bath. And he spent 2 years with two groups of young men aged 18 to 35 who are football supporters. He himself, I think, was shocked by the depth to which online gambling has penetrated the experience of watching football for these young men. And he's called it the gamblification of football. And they told him that football really means betting to them. They can't really watch a match unless they've got multiple bets on it, and that all the conversations with mates are about the odds, the bets, and not about the game itself. They have 25, one of them told him 40 different accounts with online betting companies. And it's on your phone, you've already signed up with your bank details, so it's so very, very easy to bet. There is in-play betting, so people aren't putting bets on the results of matches and waiting a day or half a day or 2 hours for the result. It's in-play on the next goal, the next corner, the next throw-in. bet, bet, bet. And campaigners that I've spoken to argue and are very concerned that this kind of in-play immediate betting is much more addictive than traditional betting. It's the rapid nature of betting that's very addictive. There are dire consequences involved with gambling, not only financial losses, obviously there is a level of addiction, and there are documented mental health problems, relationship breakdowns, and one of the campaigns called Gambling with Lives is run by the parents of a young man, Jack Ritchie, who killed himself as a result of gambling addiction. I feel that it's gone way too far, and that the football clubs and the Premier League itself, they seek to sort of justify the huge money that they make and that the players make and that people associated with the clubs make by saying that they still are community organisations and that they put in a lot of investment into communities and do community programmes. And that is true. But I think, and many people think, that this is being seriously undermined by the absolute twinning of football with gambling and the damage that that this modern explosion of gambling does. And to be honest, I wonder if they quite realise how far it's gone.
That was journalist David Conn. You can follow his work and read the full report online. That's all for today. Many thanks to David and to Jonathan Watts. We really want to know what you think and would love your feedback. Do subscribe and leave us a review wherever you're listening. Today's producers were Joshua Kelly, Mythili Rao, Amar Kalia and David Waters, with sound design by Ivor Manley. The execs are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you tomorrow.